Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Before I introduce tonight's talk, a quick programming note. Speakers Forum now has two broadcast times. You can hear it on Sunday nights at 7 or Thursday nights at 11. In this episode, Michael Bennett is a man who needs little introduction. He is famous as a professional football player, a philanthropist, and an activist. Now add author to that list. Bennett's first book, written with journalist Dave Zirin, is Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. Bennett writes that chief among those uncomfortable things is a necessary conversation about systematic racism. He urges white people to take action, quote, do something to make it better. Help us heal by standing or sitting alongside us, unquote. Though he was traded away from the Seahawks, Bennett still considers Seattle a home and the location of many significant moments in his life. He came back to talk with his friend Jesse Hagopian, a Garfield High School teacher and the author of Teaching for Black Lives. Michael Bennett and Jesse Hagopian spoke at Seattle's First Baptist Church on June 19th, Juneteenth, the American holiday that commemorates the announcement of the abolition of slavery and celebrates African-American freedom, education, and achievement. The event was presented by Town Hall Seattle. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our broadcast version here. As always, you can listen to the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum.
My name is Ware Harmon. I'm the executive director of Town Hall Seattle. This is an emotional night for a lot of reasons. It's the next to last event of our year Inside Out, and I can't think of a better way to finish this incredibly exciting year than with our back-to-back night with Michael Bennett, tonight in conversation with Jesse Hagopian. The event is part of our Civic Series, which is here courtesy the support of the Wincote Foundation Northwest, the Caffin Foundation, the True Brown Foundation, Boeing, the Real Networks Foundation, and KUOW. Together they make Town Hall possible, and especially our political programs, and they deserve our gratitude, so I'll extend it to them. So, let's start with the obvious. Michael Bennett is a Super Bowl champion. Yes, he is, damn right. Pro Bowl MVP, three-time Pro Bowler, two-time NFC champion, and was awarded King County NAACP. Michael will tell you when he takes the stage, and I've just let him down. Also received a citizenship service award from the King County NAACP, which frankly, I believe is as meaningful to him as all of the accolades he receives on the football field, but that's another matter. He's gained international recognition for his public support of the Black Lives Matter movement, women's rights, other activist and social justice causes. In 2017, he was named one of the 100 most influential African Americans by The Root, was the Seahawks nominee for the NFL's Walter Payton Man of the Year Award, was honored along with his brother Martellus with a BET Shine a Light Award. Bennett donates all of his endorsement money and the proceeds from jersey sales to health and education projects for poor and underserved youth and minority communities. And a long sentence. And recently expanded his reach globally to support STEM programs in Africa. He's in conversation tonight with Jesse Hagopian, who's a longtime friend of Town Hall. He teaches ethnic studies and is the co-advisor to the Black Student Union at Garfield High. He's an editor, that's right, Garfield in the house. He's an editor for the social justice periodical Rethinking Schools, the co-editor of the just-released book Teaching for Black Lives, and the editor of the book, all right, More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High-Stakes Testing. In 2015, Jesse received Seattle's King County NAACP Service Award, that's what it was, and was named an Education Fellow to the Progressive Magazine, as well as the Cultural Freedom Fellow for the Lannan Foundation for his nationally recognized work in promoting critical thinking and opposing high-stakes testing. Michael's book, Things That Make White People Uncomfortable, is the subject of tonight's talk. It was also the subject of last night's talk with journalist Art Thiel, which, this is true, marks the first time in almost 20 years of this organization that we've hosted a speaker on back-to-back nights. It's a big deal for us, and it's a sincere pleasure to almost close out this season at Town Hall by welcoming Jesse Hagopian and Michael Bennett.
Hey, happy Juneteenth to you, Michael.
Thank you.
And happy Juneteenth to everyone here. And happy Juneteenth to those who are live streaming on Facebook. And there's a lot of white people here. I don't know if...
Let me get a glass of water on that.
I don't know if Town Hall gave you the most uncomfortable seat, just in keeping with the theme of tonight.
A glass of water?
Yeah, I'll have a glass of water. Thank you, sir. Man, it's so good to be here with you, especially after all the nonsense that you had to go through and we had to postpone the first one. But to be here right now after all the work you put in on this book is really special. I'm really excited to be here with you tonight.
Yeah, I'm super excited, too, to be able to come back to, like, basically, like, my second home, because Seattle is where a lot of stuff happened for me and where, you know, I was able to have a child, you know, build my foundation and meet a lot of people and do a lot of work in this city. So to be here right now is just everything. And I'm very humble. I'm grateful. And I'm just honored to be able to have this many people show up to a book event. Usually people show up to jerseys and when you sign in jerseys, but to people to respect you as an intellectual and to be able to come and share your story with them is super unique.
No doubt. Man, this city's gonna miss you. After all, your identity is wrapped up in this city, and we're gonna miss the sack dance. Yeah.
But you know, I'm not leaving this city. Like, that's just the crazy thing about sports. Is like we talked about this before. It's like they can trade you from a city for a sports, but they can't trade you for being a part of the city. See, me, I'm a part of the city because my foundation and everything I do for the community is still going on. Regardless if I'm here or not, I still come back and I still do all the stuff that I promised that I said I was going to do. There's so many people that I've made promises to that I got to keep up with.
No doubt. And I think I looked at the schedule and I don't think you play the Seahawks this year.
No, Russell Wilson's lucky.
Oh, he got lucky.
Rashad Penny. Paul Allen, Pete Carroll. Oh, I'm not going to sleep for it. I sleep every day, eat perfect every night to play the Seahawks. Right. Bobby, you know Bobby.
Right on. So you have a chapter in the book called The Brotherhood that really like looks at the unique locker room that is the Seattle Seahawks, or at least was.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, like, I really got into the Seahawks first when Marshawn Lynch kind of claimed his humanity and refused to just answer all these questions the media wanted. And then when I saw you claim your humanity by answering the questions, but on your own terms, like saying, like, when Marshawn did Beast Mode 2.0, like, what'd you say? Like, the greatest run since the Underground Railroad?
Yeah. It was.
That's what drew me in, made me want to be a Seahawks fan. Like, talk about these guys in the locker room.
I think it's not very often that you're able to create a family atmosphere. I think for the Seahawks, the people that I play with, whether it was Bobby or KJ or Richard Earl or Cam or Cliff, who all these people are like brothers to me, you know. The first thing you ask them is not how you feeling. It's like, how's your family doing? You know, because we were connected on a spiritual level, and so we knew what the other was doing at all times because we spent so much time together. We would talk and we would have real conversation. We never ever talked about sports. You know, Bobby would come to my locker like, what you reading? And then I'd throw it to him and then we would talk about it. Or he'll ask me a question, I'll ask him a question. Or Cliff, we just had like a real family atmosphere. So it was like every time we took the field, we knew that the person next to us, they was playing for the person next to them. And it wasn't about, they were ever playing about themselves. It was like, if Bobby wanted me to hold a gap for him, I would do it, because I knew that he wanted me to do it. And I felt like if you had people on your team that made you feel like that, it was easy to go on the field like that. And I think the brotherhood that we share, we also took it from the field into the community. I mean, you go to a lot of teams, and my brother, he always used to be jealous of our team, because he used to say, man, I've never been around a team that all you guys are always hanging out. You know, there's guys.
Talking about Martellus.
Yeah, my brother Martellus, he'd be like, man, I couldn't wait to get on a team like that. And that's how our team was. We took it from the field into the community, and we would do all types of works together. And whoever called and was like, hey, can you show up? We would be there on time and make sure that we were able to lend a helping hand. And I think that's what made us a unique team. And I think the city of Seattle will never, ever see something like that again, because that's like a once-in-a-lifetime type of opportunity where we were so selfless that we never talked about ourselves. We always talked about the guy next to us, and that's why we forever be brothers. And beyond the sports, you know, beyond the wins, it's about, man, how you doing, how you feeling, what you been up to, texting out of nowhere and just be like, hey, you the best I ever played with, just to remind them, like, we didn't take any moment for granted.
No doubt. That's beautiful, man. Yeah. We could feel it in this city, too.
Yeah.
Besides the brotherhood in the locker room, I mean, you talk a lot in the book about your actual family, yeah, and you're pretty raw. And open about that. Yeah. And I remember Dave and I went to your house to do some of the early talks about the book, and we were talking about your mom.
Yeah.
And it was like, wasn't long after you had just reconnected with her.
Yeah, no, but that was a really interesting moment too. I know, usually I get choked up about it, but I said, no, I'm not getting choked up about it tonight. I'm gonna talk through it. But, you know, that was a really interesting time though, because it was four men in there crying when we were like going over the edit, and we were just all connected because you guys are my friends, so you knew the pain that I was sharing and how I was like, man, I don't know if I really want to be that open to people. And you know guys are, and everybody was just saying like, just be vulnerable. I think, you know, to be able to be vulnerable and to be able to forgive somebody for something that you feel like they wronged you is a hard thing to do, but once you do it, it just frees you. You know what I'm saying? You kind of just don't hold on to the anger and the pain, and there you have to find a way to find empathy and compassion. And for me, that was like a true journey, you know, to be able to forgive my mother and build up that relationship. Because honestly, I honestly felt that if I didn't forgive my mother, I could never love my wife to the maximum of my ability. I couldn't be the greatest father I could possibly be if I couldn't like forgive my mom.
No, I mean, we were in that room, you had us all sobbing.
Oh, man, I know, but that's the truth, you know. It's like, you know, for an athlete, you know, you built on Bravo and the, you know, how you come up and how strong you are and how you are able to play through certain things, but you never ever share with kids the ability to be vulnerable. And I think that's what I wanted to share with kids through this book, is to be able to be very vulnerable and be real with them and let them know, like, if you're dealing with something and you're dealing with something that's bothering you, to be able to let go. I think a lot of players, they deal with depression because we have no outlets. We have no way to be able to cry. We almost like the military, because we're never able to get off. We always have to play through injuries, and nobody ever cares about how you feel. And so for us as a player, we want to find those ways to have those outlets, so we don't have these, you know, suicidal thoughts or these thoughts where we abusing our wives or not being a father that we could possibly be. Because a lot of players, they deal with the family issues, but nobody's there to talk to them. And I think a lot of coaches don't have that outlet. I think the Seahawks are very rare in that, because we're the only team that has a team psychiatrist for people to be able to talk through traumatic issues that happen to them. Because we all deal with traumatic issues, and all of us are masked up, and we try not to let anybody into our true circle or our true feelings, because nobody ever wants to be seen as weak, you know. But vulnerability is not a weakness, it's a strength. It's the ability to be able to open up and share the truth of how you really feel.
No, man, that's the power of this book, that you are vulnerable in it, and the fact that you allow me to be vulnerable that way, like, that's a lesson that I'll take with me forever, you know, that it's okay, you know, that we can have emotions.
Yeah, we have to have emotions. I think not having emotions is what allowed things to happen like they do now, to not have empathy, not to have compassion. That's why we we fight about the border issues. When we, as human beings, we should have empathy and compassion for somebody losing their child. We all have children, and to think of your mind to be thinking that, you know, a mother is detached from the child that they birthed is a hard thing to swallow. And I think those things and being able to be vulnerable, things like that won't happen. And I think those are the things that we got to be connected to. You know, you look at police brutality, when we're looking at somebody, you know, you stop and you got to see them for a human. And I think not being vulnerable and not have empathy and not having compassion has brought us into a world that is scary sometimes. And I think the ability to be able to talk about that and have men, especially men, to connect to their feelings is something that we really have to move forward in as in a society.
No doubt. Thank you. And going on that, you also have a whole chapter in the book on feminism and why you're a feminist, and the lessons you've learned from your wife and your three daughters, and another whole chapter on intersectionality, right? Talk about those chapters, why they're important to you.
You know, like, for me, like, you know, I'm, like I was saying yesterday and all the time, is like, obviously, I'm an athlete and I'm a famous person, so I get all the credit a lot of the times. But my wife, which is here right there, stand up. Can she get a round of applause? Because she's just as equal to me when it comes to all this stuff. So for me, like, watching her go through her journeys and her struggles and what she grows to, and watching her grow up as a woman and a person in the community who builds and does things for people, is an emotional thing. So for me, I'm tied to that, you know? And for my wife, that's everything. So for my kids, it's the same thing. I share those messages with them to let them know, like, shit, I love
them. It's all right, you know? It's all right, man, yep. Shit. I feel, man. Your wife's an amazing person. I've learned a lot. I found out yesterday some about her background in organizing and activism, and I've realized where you get it.
Nah, for real, like, she's so strong, and like, there's a lot of women who are super strong. If you look at the civil rights movement or any other movement, Harriet Tubman was the person who was going back and risking her life, you know, and Angela Davis, whoever it was, it's always been women who have always stood up, you know. You know, Katrina's right here. She's right here every day fighting for her cousin. Charlene allows, and she's over there every day fighting for herself. And she's my friend, and to talk to her when she's a mother and she's out there risking every day because what she believes in, it gives me power to know that, you know, women are just as equal to men when it comes to everything. And it's not just about because we have a penis or something like that, it makes us better. No, it just makes us different. But at the same time, they're human beings and they deserve to have respect. You know, when I think about Me Too movement, I think about my daughter. I try to put myself in those situations and how I would feel as a father to think that my daughter was, you know, going through something like that and not being able to have a voice. And she's being victimized because people don't see her as an equal human being. And those are the things that why I feel like it's important for men to be feminist, because we have to be able to speak on issues pertaining to women, or are they going to lose their voice? And who wants their mother to lose their voice? Who wants their wife to lose their voice? Who wants their daughter to lose their voice? We can't have that happen, because, you know, there comes a point where silence becomes dishonesty, and we have to make sure that we're never silent about issues that we believe in.
No doubt. Thank you. Man, that's why we're friends right there, man. In that chapter on intersectionality, I wanna just ask one more question about, because, man, you talk about an issue in there about Palestine that I want to hit on for a second, because I called you up on the phone.
Yeah.
It was only like 2 weeks after we met.
Yeah.
And this was like the scaredest I've ever been on a phone call. Like, probably since eighth grade, and yeah. I asked a girl out.
And what'd the girl say?
She said, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, shit. It wasn't that scary.
So I call you up, and I was like, because I just found out you were scheduled to go to Israel on a state-sponsored trip to play in front of Trump and Netanyahu to show this wonderful collaboration between the two. And I was like, man, I haven't told you this, but I was pretty scared, because I was like, "This, I'm gonna tell this guy not to go."
A free trip, first class.
Yeah, free trip.
First class, all the food we can eat. Nah, that was
right. And it's like, what was it, like next week?
I feel like the Matrix when that guy took that steak and we got unplugged.
Right.
But I didn't do it.
Oh, man. So I was just like, raised some issues, and I was amazed by how open you were immediately to like wanting to learn more.
No, for me, that was a hard issue because it was one of those things that, you know, it's a polarizing conversation about who's right or who's wrong about that situation. And at the end of the day, people are dying every single day. And that's what I connect with. I connect with the bodies and the empathy and the families. And for me, that was an easy choice to be able to not go, because I understand the connection between all people, all oppressed people, the people in Haiti, Native American issues, the women issues, transgender issues, every type of issue is connected on every single level. And for you to really be a global human being or a global citizen, and you call yourself a true patriot for people, then you have to understand every single issue, and you can't pick and choose which ones matter, because at the end of the day, they all matter. Every time, people always scream like, you know, all lives matter, but not when it comes to certain situations. You know, when you scream all lives matter, then you gotta feel the pain when you see Charlene Lau's kids crying for their mother. You gotta feel the pain when you see Michael Brown's mother crying for a lost son. You gotta feel the pain with Tamir Rice and her family, Sandra Bland, who these people are losing their families. And when you watch TV, you see the bombs hitting Gaza, you gotta feel the pain for people. And I think when you look at the Native American issues, you feel the pain for the people. Or I look at brown people, Spanish people looking at the edge and being pulled from their families, that brings a certain amount of pain to my heart, you know, and it's got to be able to speak on those issues, because those people matter. Those people, they have a voice. And when we sitting up here and we picking and choosing, and we watching the Kardashians or, you know, Family Feud, I love the Family Feud too, but at the same time, it's like, you know, who cares if Kanye drops a new CD when you're looking at the immigration issues? Like, who cares about that kind of stuff when you really look at the core and the essence of what a human being's true job is? It's like, we have to be able to connect to people on every single level. And I've never been to a place where I didn't want to help somebody, because I grew up like that. That's the way that my wife grew up, and that's the way that I grew up. And so we're always finding ways to connect to people. And we always think like state, national, city, globally. How do you connect to people and feel people's voices and you feel people's pain to help them find a way to change?
No doubt. So there's another issue you talk about in the book. You have a chapter called Without Food, Your Ass is Gonna Die. Talk about
Before I talk about this chapter, I have to, you know, recognize somebody who works for my foundation, and all she does is fight food deserts. And Lika, could you stand up, please, real fast?
Yeah.
So she's like my voice on that. The first time we were working together, and I brought the issue up of sugar, and I was like, you know, sugar stands for slavery. And she was like, oh, okay, now we can talk. And ever since then, we've been really good friends.
And she came into my room and did a lesson on
that. I know. And so our foundation is, that part of my foundation is based on the food deserts and the lack of, you know, nutrition, or the lack of access to, you know, supermarkets and fresh vegetables. I lived in a neighborhood where there was only one grocery store. You know, you live where 20,000 or 60,000 people, and people don't have access to fresh food. And, you know, there's 23.8 million people living in food deserts in America. And I think it's something I read something one day that said 6.8 million of them are kids. To think about that, kids, we all take for granted food. And, you know, to think about, there's places where, you know, where I go to Haiti and I'm like, oh, wow, people don't have food. And then I go to South Dakota with the Sioux tribe and I'm like, well, people don't have food here. You know, I'll drive to downtown somewhere in Seattle and there's homeless people who don't have food. It's like, there's so many food deserts, and food is a big issue because health is wealth. You know what I'm saying? Health is a part of your growth. And there's kids who go to school every single day that they don't even get one meal. And it's the idea that people don't even understand about the food that they're eating, and how, as an athlete, you are a conduit of brands, and brands come up to you and they offer you large sums of money to speak for them. You know, what do I look like saying that I represent McDonald's when that is not the truth? McDonald's is one of the biggest issues in America. Coca-Cola, like, these are companies that we all share that prey on people that are brown and black every single day. And they put their stuff up, they give us free stuff, and then they give us money to, you know, to merchant, to sell to our people these things that we know that are bad. You know, we look at the brown or the Samoan culture or the black people in these different, who dealing with these diabetes issues, and it's all stemming from the food, the greasy foods that we eat. And it's time for us to stop that. And it's time for athletes to step up and really be the ones who say, we're not representing that anymore. We're about the people. And I think that's what's really important.
Yeah. Thank you. So let's make white people uncomfortable right now. Nah. and talk about...
I think that issue of food, is it should make everybody uncomfortable. The idea that, you know, as a human being, as we sit at our table and we break bread and we eat the, you know, salmon, you know, Copper River salmon is really good.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. I just had some.
And to think that, you know, there's somebody who doesn't even have a piece of bread, you know, let alone breakfast, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, and so, you know, that's a hard thing to fathom. And I think we as people have to continuously fight these issues. I think about, you know, there's an iPhone 10, you know, that could recognize your face, you know. Or there's a new car that's about to fly, or this, all these new inventions that people are inventing, and me and my brother are like, damn, we're fucking missing a step if we're making flying cars before we feed people, you know? And it's like...
No doubt. That's a crazy contradiction.
That's a crazy contradiction. Damn it, Steve Jobs, I miss you, but shit. I love my iPod, but goddamn, we need to feed the people.
I'm with you. Yeah, no. So moving to the conversation that I think we need to have, that I haven't seen you have yet on this book tour, but the one that I think will definitely help to make people uncomfortable here is about the N-word chapter.
Yeah.
And you know, you talk about the difference about if a white person uses it and if a black person uses it, but then you kind of actually apologize to your daughters.
Yeah,
what's that about?
It's one of those things like, you have to be able to self-reflect and like, before you start to go out and try to be like, well, the people should do this, then you have to like self-reflect on what's your part in this. And you know, I played a pivotal part in, you know, using the N-word and sharing it in a way that I shouldn't have been sharing it. And so for me, Maya Angelou, you know, reading her words and thinking about how she felt about that and the disconnect between, you know, older black people and younger black people, like what that word means to them. That's a word of you know, that brings up death. That's a word that brings up, you know, segregation. That's a word that brings up, you know, lack of opportunity. That's a word that brings up slavery. That's a word that brings up pain. And for me, you know, growing up, that was an adjective, a pronoun, a verb, you know, being able to use that word in different places and make a sentence. And for me, you know, the first thing I want to do was apologize to my ancestors, because me using that word the way that I did is basically a slap in their faces. It's basically a slap in their journey or what they've been through. It's basically, you know, discrediting what it meant to them to make it through, you know, slavery, to make it through segregation, to make it through Jim Crow, to make it through all these different issues, and have that word be on top of their head. I think about that word as the last word that Emmett Till heard. I think about that as the last word, you know, people hanging from the tree, you know, whether, you know, Billie Holiday, you know, and they, you know, singing that song, you know, Strange Fruit, Nina Simone. I'm thinking about those are the words that people were hearing before they met their last breath. And so for me, that chapter was a very reflective chapter, because it was about the growth from that, you know, and what it means for when I think white people said. I think I apologize to my ancestors because I allowed some of my friends who were white to be able to use that word around me in an unconscious way, you know, and to be able to not let them to be like, look, you know, that word is a word that I shouldn't be using, and your ass should definitely not be using it.
Right.
And if you say it again, I'm a karate chop, you know? So that chapter was really hard, because that word brings two different things. I feel like for white people, it's a truth word. It's where life was, you know, what that word mean. It was a word of people who let that word grow, and it was a divide of people who wanted that word to change society. And for us, you know, that word means a lot. It brings back the past. It brings back where we've been, where we need to go. And I think me talking about that word is something that a lot of young black people need to hear and a lot of white people need to hear. They need to understand what that word really means to society, and that when you say it, people know it, because they know when they say that word to you, you're gonna get aggy, you're gonna get angry, you're gonna become what they want you to become, because it's a word that they know that your ancestors, they think that you need to retaliate. But being trying to be yoga and meditating and stuff, it's about bringing that back and making sure that I don't even say that word anymore, so that word has no strength to me anymore.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that perspective, because I've heard black people lecture younger black people as if that's the only like using that word is why we have problems in our community. Yeah. But the perspective you brought to it, about the history of that word, and instead of just scolding people who use it, like looking at yourself and trying to root it in that history, was powerful to me.
I think you have to do that all the time, because when you're talking to people, last thing people want to hear is you coming from a place where you feel like you're better than them, and you have no past, and you've just been perfect. And when you when you're able to reflect on it and unmask yourself, and you know, be able to share your message, people listen. And I think when you talk about a word that's so dehumanizing, you know, it has to bring up those type of things. You have to look in the mirror and wonder where you were and how you made that word even more powerful. And now you have to take that word back and put it where it needs to be.
And I think I remember you telling the story about the first time you heard it.
Yeah.
You were pretty young.
Yeah.
And I connected with that because I remember I was in preschool.
Yeah.
Somebody called me that. And I had the exact same experience. I didn't know what it meant, but I knew it was meant at me and not other kids, right?
Well, because I grew up where it was like, that was just a normal word, like, hey, pass the peas, you know what I mean? Like, where we going? You know, that's my, you know, that was how we talked. And like, and when I heard that word, I felt like he wasn't coming from that place. I felt like he was coming from a place of anger, mm-hmm. and a place of where he wanted me to be a certain way. And so for me, you know, as I got older, I started to understand, you know, it takes time. When I talk to my friends and I'm like, hey, I'm not using that word anymore, they'd be like, what word are you going to use then? I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, there's a million words out there. Let's we can find one. What about duh or the bro or chicken or something other than that word? Now my friends, I'm like, bro, we can say something else. And so, like, as you say, if you talk to young people and you change the people one by one and they're sharing that message, it becomes like a tree. Everything starts to change. You plant that seed and people start to grow, you know?
Right on. Right on. So I want to talk about another phone call I had with you real quick. I called you. You were on the way to the first preseason game. And I said, did you hear that Marshawn sat for the anthem?
Yeah.
And you said, yeah, you'd heard about that, but you didn't say anything about what you were about to do.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, like, did you already know on that bus that you were about to sit for the anthem and really shake up this world? And,
yeah,
and what's behind the anthem?
I think at the time, like, I've been sitting talking to Kaepernick and kind of like, I feel like without him being in the NFL, the message was going to be lost, and people were going to forget, and we were just going to move on and kick that ball, and we were going to be like, life is great, and everybody has equality. And as you watch in Virginia, and you see Charlottesville, and you see all these different things that's happening. You see people dying. You see more police brutality. You see so many more issues that you connected with. You have no choice. You know, I told Coach Carroll, I was like, look, Coach Carroll, like, what I've experienced and the people that I've seen and the people that I have represented and the people that I owe this to, I cannot be silent, because I owe it to them to have a voice. I owe it to them to share their stories. I owe it to every single person that I have encountered with on my journey to let them know that their story and their voice isn't lost. And having that conversation with Coach Carroll, he kind of understood, because he was like, I can't really tell you not to do what you need to do, because I understand where you're coming from. And as a man, I told Coach Carroll, I said, Coach Carroll, it's hard for you to understand what it's like to be a black man in this world. You know, I can put this helmet on every single day, but when I take that helmet off, you know, who knows what could happen to me? Who knows how people feel about me? But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, because I still got to speak for these people and have that voice. And so that was where my mind was as I saw that. And I felt like it was no choice but to sit and make sure that the message doesn't get lost. And I think we had to do a good job of keep talking about it and making sure that, you know, the message doesn't get lost, like I said.
Yeah, yeah. What, talk about that message, because of course the media tries to paint it, and Trump tries to paint it as protesting the flag.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a lot more to it. I mean, one thing to point out is that actually the person that wrote the national anthem was actually celebrating slavery in a verse that we don't sing anymore. But if you go Google it, you will find the verse that celebrates the killing of black slaves.
Yeah. No, I think for me, it's when it comes to Trump and that situation, to me, it's more like propaganda. I think propaganda does something to people's mind. If you look at World War II, like, the propaganda made people feel like murdering and exterminating Jewish people was okay, because they seen enough propaganda that they started to believe it. You know, with slavery, they seen enough propaganda that they felt like it was okay. And I think for us, people started having propaganda and trying to divide the message, what we were really talking about. Their true message was equality and freedom for every single person on this planet. And I think people lost that. And I think that's the most American thing that you can do, is fight for equality for other people, regardless of how they look like.
Right on. So you have another chapter in the book called A Moment of Silence.
Yeah.
And I think that connects to why you sat for the anthem this year. And it was one of the most powerful chapters to me, man. Talk about what you did with that chapter.
I think I was talking to one of my friends, who's one of my closest friends, his name Cyril, and I was talking to him, and I was like, bro, I just need to put something in there that's not really in my opinion or really my thoughts on it. It needs to be something that's like really true. And I was like, I think I'm gonna do this. And he was like, that's the one, you know, do that, you know? And so it was like, to put a chapter in there that had no voice and no my opinion, it was just pure facts. It was pure facts that police brutality isn't a black issue or a brown issue. It's just a human being issue. There's people of all colors who have been struck by tragedy because of the police officers or police brutality, certain people. I don't believe that every single police officer is bad. That's, for me, if you think that, then you're just being silly to think that every single person is representing that. But what I was trying to say is that there are a lot of people who dehumanize people and don't see people that have value. And for me, that's what that chapter was about. It was showing that these names are people that get missed, you know. These are true people who lost their life for no apparent reason, who were unarmed and didn't have anything to do with the way that they died, you know. And it was the fact that I wanted people to go research those stories. I wanted people to go find out what their families felt. I wanted people not to be divided on the issue of, was it right or was it wrong? I wanted people to bring it back to human. The human level of it is that everybody, when a person is murdered or a person dies, they're leaving somebody behind. They're leaving kids behind. They're leaving it. You know, as I went to the memorial of Charlene Lyles yesterday, I didn't see tons of people. I saw her family. I saw families. There was, when it was on TV, it was people who were divided. Oh, this. But yesterday, I saw family. I saw kids who were hurt. I saw grandmothers who were hurt. I saw cousins. I saw people who really felt that. And for me, that's what that chapter was about. It was about reconnecting to those families who have lost those voices. We talk those people's name, and we forget that they were somebody. They were mothers. They were fathers. They were brothers. They were sisters. They was, you know, teammates. They were somebody that had a voice that lost it. And I think that's what it really boils down to, is really coming back to the essence and being like, oh, a person died. You know, we have been so, you know, we'd be so desensitized to death that we don't even see death as an issue anymore. We just see it as a part of life, and we just be like, oh, somebody died. Like, you know, what happened? Like, you know, nobody digs into what Anthony Bourdain was going through, why somebody that was so successful takes their own life, or what is Junior Seau's feeling when he decides to take his life, or what is Kate Spade feeling? We don't never dig into that. We just see it. We go to Burger King or McDonald's, and then we move on with our day. We don't ever try to connect to the families and say, hey, what's the son feeling? What's the mother feeling like? And I think that's what that chapter was really about, was giving those people, making those people human again.
No doubt. If you haven't seen it yet, that chapter just lists the names of every single person last year who was unarmed and was killed by police, and just listing their names. And it's powerful because it's disproportionately black and brown, But there's also a lot of white people also in that chapter,
there's
too.
There's tons of white people, Asian people. It's just humans. Yeah. And, like, at that point, I'm not even looking at color. I'm just looking at humans. I'm just seeing human being, 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 human being. I'm not looking at, oh, is he black or is he white or is he Chinese or is he this or is he that? I'm just looking at, like, that's a person. That's a person. That's a person. That's a person. I should feel pain for that person. I should feel pain for their families.
I mean, and that gets me to really what was the most scariest phone call that we had. When you called me at 3 in the morning, I knew it wasn't good. When you, thankfully, your name wasn't added to that to that chapter.
Yeah.
But, man, that was hard.
No, that was a hard thing because it's, like I said, people, you live in the public eye, so people want to make their decisions of whether, oh, did he deserve it, or he shouldn't have been there. But at the end of the day, nobody was connected to my kids. Like, who, for me at that moment, I'm thinking about my wife. I'm thinking about my son. I mean, thinking about my daughters. I'm thinking about my brother. I'm thinking about my mom. I'm thinking about my dad. I'm not thinking whether, you know, should he do it or should he not. I'm just thinking about, like, the family, what my kids are going to do if they lose their father. And I'm thinking, people didn't connect to that. People wanted to connect to, because it's such a polarizing issue that nobody ever wants to reflect on it. Nobody wants to look in the mirror and be like, there is an issue. It's not to everybody starts to look at it and be like, at the end of the day, is he a human or not? Does he have family? And so for me, that's what really that was about.
Yeah. I mean, when you told me that an officer had put a weapon to your head and threatened your life, all I could think about is losing a friend and what Seattle was going to lose and what our movements internationally were going to lose, that we're struggling for justice and had just found this new voice, and it was overwhelming. I mean, we were upset, crying.
Yeah, everybody was upset, but, you know, those kind of traumatic issues, they shape you and they try to, you know, those experiences or those examples are something that you, it makes you want to have a voice. It makes you want to be able to share your story, because there's a whole bunch of people who didn't that doesn't have a voice, who passed away that can't speak for themselves, or people who don't know the story. I think my story just brings other people into, okay, let's really look at the underlying issues in America. Let's really find out what's going on and how can we solve these problems.
No doubt. Well, I'm so glad you're with us, and I want you to talk a little bit about what you think the role of an athlete is in social movements.
I think the role of an athlete is a very tricky subject, because people see athletes and they think that athletes should be grateful. You made it. Shut up, be quiet, run that ball, dunk it, jump over that hurdle, do what you can. I need to be entertained today. It's Sunday, 1 o'clock. I had a long ass week, and the Seahawks need to win. And maybe I'll do something after. So athletes, you know, you're dealing with brands, you're dealing with your team, you're dealing with the fans, and you have to make a conscious choice of what is it that really matters. Is it the wins? The wins do matter in a certain place, or is it your humanity? You're challenging your humanity versus morals and the ethics of money and all these different things, and you have to make a choice of, like, what am I supposed to do? I have great leadership and great people before me who've done the things that they're supposed to do when they were athletes and they had a voice, whether it was John or Dr. Harry Edwards or whether it was Muhammad or Craig Hodges, whoever it was, Kaepernick, whoever it was, there's so many great examples. And now I live in a generation where I've been, you know, where we got LeBron James, an athlete who has everything to lose, but still is able to speak on social issues in a way that hasn't been done before. And I think with his leadership, it allows us to be able to speak and have a voice. I think that's something that, you know, we really have to share. And I think we play a big role because we are people look up to us. You know, we are real role models, but our role model doesn't stop at shoe brands. Our role model doesn't stop at fast food or selling these different products. Our role model really starts at the core of what it really is, you know, where we can't be silent, you know, about real issues. That is really what a role model is. That is really what we're supposed to be doing when we get up there on that platform. Of course, we're supposed to score the touchdowns, you know, do the dunks, but at the same time, we're also supposed to speak for the people who don't have a voice. And every single athlete knows that, is whether or not we choose to do it or not, and whether we are able to walk amongst fear and make sure that, you know, what people write about us doesn't bother us or the brands that we lose. Because when you talk about stuff like that, you lose brands. That's just peer economics. You know, people don't want to choose between right or wrong. You know what I mean? They want to choose what they think is going to sell. Business is about bottom line. It's not about the exits. If that was the case, Shell Oil would not be in the Amazon leaving residue behind. Or people drilling oil on Native American lands, or Flint, Michigan oil, or the issues with gun violence wouldn't be an issue because people would be like, you know, at the end of the day, that is right. Like, kids should be safe at school, you know? And so for me, that's really what athletes have a voice is that we can share. We the only people who are able to have a billion people at one time through Instagram and Twitter, and we share things about things that we're doing, but we never share about issues that are affecting our humanity and our communities.
No doubt. No doubt, and right on. I'm glad you said the names of John Carlos and Muhammad Ali, and we've had some incredible sports figures from throughout history who have jumped all the way into social movements and helped amplify them and been a big part of it. But one thing that you write about in the book is how what's missing was like an organization, like coming together in collective struggle.
Yeah, I think. You know, I just wanted to write about an organization that was kind of like, you know, like the Red Cross or an organization that represents athletes, that athletes have voices around the whole world. Because there's an athlete who plays soccer that's from Senegal that plays for France, who's seeing all these issues in Senegal, and he needs the people to support him on those issues. Or you know, Maya Moore, or you know, all these different athletes who are dealing with issues of the trans and transgender issues that are happening within the women's sports or men's. I was in you know, in New Zealand and watching the Commonwealth Games, and there was an issue there. And to be able to have a collective voice of athletes around the world to really show what we really are truly about and the humanity, and that if we had created a organization, people won't be scared to share their feelings because they'll have support. You know, they'll have Ronaldo, they'll have Messi, they'll have people who are dealing with things that, you know, we can share and share our message and share our struggles and, you know, and unmask ourselves to really show who we are as human beings.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. And I mean, we've been talking about that idea for a while, and then jumping into working with Athletes for Impact has been amazing. And I hope it takes off and a lot of other athletes get on board, because I think that power could really transform not only the sports world, but the whole world.
Yeah, true story.
No doubt. I want to begin to wrap up here, but you look good tonight, and I'm wondering.
Thank you. I was unsure.
Did you get that from Africa?
Yeah, I just got back from Africa and Senegal, and for me, like, that was like a really inspiring trip. It was a very transformational trip. It was everything that I needed at the time of my life. As my friends text me, I'm like, man, I'm having such a great time. But it was a very reflective trip, because like, me being African American and not having a connection to Africa, but not really having a connection to, you know, the history of America, because the history of an African American person in America starts with the transatlantic slave, and it starts with post-colonialism. It starts with it starts with colonialism for us. And for us, you know, that's hard to do, but that's a hard path to see a brighter future when you look at it and you think about the heart and the pain that people felt, never talking about the true journey of the African slave or the African American, you know. And so for me, going back to Africa was that connection. It was the connection to the past, and it was connection to who I am as a person, because my ancestors are Mandinka. They are true warriors. So for the essence, I'm already built for a warrior, because I am a Mandinka, you know what I'm saying? So for me, that journey was a true journey, because every night was a reflective night. You know, I'm not scared to admit that every night was an emotional night for me, because it was, you know, I cried with my wife on multiple occasions on that night. You know, for us to sit there and be there and think about, you know, like, dang, like, my grandmother left this place 400 years ago, and I'm the first person to actually bring her spirit back or bring her essence back. You know, to think about, you know, as a father, if I lose my daughter in a safe way, I go crazy. I'm like, where is she? Where is she? You know, where is she? And to think that my grandfather, he lost his daughter and never ever saw her again. You know, that's a painful thing to deal with, a very reflective thing. You know, You know, I dealt with that with rage. I dealt with that with calmness. I dealt with that with patience. I dealt with that with elegance. You know what I mean? At the same time was to be able to, you know, understand and be able to feel that, you know, to walk into the house of slaves and, you know, and think about all these people at the bottom of this building being treated like animals. As people watch, you know, women and mothers and child getting torn apart, fathers being just 3 feet away from their child, hearing their child yell, but to be helpless, you know, to be helpless and not be able to change what is happening to your child as they're being chained, you know, as they're being sold, as they're being prodded, as they're being fed to be sold like cattle. That's a very reflective thing for a human to deal with. That is one of the most hardest things I've ever had to deal with, because that is the truth. That is not not fake. That's not fictional. These are facts. These are facts. The chains of my ancestors are still there. You know, the history is still there. I look at the point of no return, an empty hole, a hallway, people being drugged from their family as they scream and nails stuck into walls as they crawl and they try not to be sold, they try not to be pulled from their child and thrown on a boat, never to realize what has ever happened to their family or their children or their husband, only to be feel like lost and rather take their lives and just jump over at the end of the boat than rather to be slaves. And for that, at the same time, that's what the bottom looks like. The bottom looks like that. The bottom looks like that, but at the top, it's very comfortable. There's a white guy up there who has a plush living room, like a Manhattan, New York apartment, with all the fine things, a nice view of the ocean in Senegal, because Senegal's on the ocean, and, you know, a plush bathroom and as many concubines as he wanted, as they raped the women every single day. A woman had to deal with that. So it's not just dealing with the essence of, you know, slavery and oppression. It's also dealing with women's issues as a woman's That's right. body is being controlled and she has no way of being free because that man holds the keys to her life. It's either death or sex. So what do you think she's going to have to do? Some women took their life, others dealt with sex. And so for that, that's a hard thing to deal with. And every single night, that was a passionate and emotional thing as I sit under the moonlight, and it's beautiful as the stars are bouncing off the ocean and the moon is as bright as a New York City and Times Square. The moon is coming bouncing off the ocean, and I'm very reflective, you know, as I sit there in calmness and I pray and I think about the water going back and forth and what it feels like at night. You know, as my ancestors on that boat every night hearing this water and calling out and singing spiritual songs that, you know, reflective of who they are as Mandinkas and who they are as Fulani and Jolof people, if they're singing and not being able to speak the same dialect and knowing that they can never, ever be back. That is a journey that not everybody can take. You know, that is a journey that I cannot take alone. I had to go with my wife. I could have never done that alone if I didn't have a strong woman who was able to let me be emotional, who was able to be emotional and to be understanding. Not like, oh, don't do that, but to listen, you know. And I think that is what I took from that trip, is the pain and the anguish of things that I won't let happen again, things that I know that shouldn't happen again, and to be able to share this story with other young Black people who can take this journey for them, but other Caucasian people, so they can hear the pain of what that feels like when you're in there and you hear chains popping and you see what, you know, what it is to be confined, you know, and what it is for a person not to eat, but to be funneled food through their mouth so they can be healthy enough to sell. You know, those things are hard things to deal with, you know. And then while you're in Africa, you know, there's some emotional times for me there, but the young girls who I felt that one of my schools that we deal with computer science and technology that we dealt with kids, you know, we sat around tables with young women that are powerful. They're some of the most powerful, young, confident women I've ever seen in my life. They're dealing with things that, you know, we can never deal with. We get mad when we in traffic and we can't, the goddamn Uber's taking too long. You know, we get mad when we at Chick-fil-A and they ran out of Chick-fil-A sauce. Like, I love Chick-fil-A sauce too. But when you at Chick-fil-A and they run out of Chick-fil-A sauce and they got no more Polynesian sauce, you get mad, you know. And these women are dealing with, these young girls are dealing with real life issues. As we sit there and we talking to these young girls, me and my wife, we sit back and we listen. Obviously, we don't speak the language, and so we talk to our translator and we say, hey, what do you kids want to be? And every single kid said something that I never thought I'd hear kids say. I heard one girl say, she said, I want to be a police officer. I asked her why. She said, because I want to stop the rapes. I want to stop people from getting raped. I saw one girl, she was like, I want to be a doctor. My mom died in the hospital because we had no way of getting her into the room. So people in Senegal die every single day because they don't have a waiting room and they pick and choose who they want. Or they don't have IV. I want to be an IV technician so people don't die and they can get their IVs. Or I want to stop cancer because we don't have any cancer centers here. I want people to stop dying for HIV. It's like those are the things that kids that are going through something are thinking about. They're not thinking about when I'm gonna get my latest iPad or when it's something like that. You know, when somebody tells you something so powerful, like, I'm so poor, I can't even hope no more. You know, that's, hope is the last thing that we all hold on to. Hope is the thing that, what gets us through so many situations as people is hope. It's the idea that there could be a better day. But when somebody tells you, I don't even have hope no more, because I want to come to school and eat, but I don't have food. You know what I mean? I want to be great, but there is no opportunity. And for me, that's what that trip was about. It was about realizing that, you know, there's issues around this world that people that don't have a voice, and my job and my wife's job is to continuously build bridges and help people go through things and help them find solutions. And that's what that trip was about. It was about making amends for my ancestors and letting them rest. And it was also about going home and doing the work that needs to be done for my people. And I think that's what it was, that trip was about.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Michael Bennett is the co-author with journalist Dave Zirin of Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. He spoke with teacher, activist, and author Jesse Hagopian at Seattle's First Baptist Church on June 19th. The event was presented by Town Hall Seattle. We present what we can in the broadcast/podcast hour of Speakers Forum. You can always hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. While you're there, check out our other great Seattle area talks or subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcast. A quick programming note, Speakers Forum now has two broadcast times. You can hear it on Sunday nights at 7 or Thursday nights at 11. Tune in again soon.